Case number 07-1425 et al. Cablevision Systems Corporation petitioner versus Federal Communications Commission et al. Mr. Brands for the petitioners, Mr. Joshi for the respondents, and Ms. Walker for the interveners.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Hank Brands, and I represent Cablevision in this proceeding, and this morning I will also speak for Comcast. I'd like to address 4 points, if I can, this morning. First of all, I'd like to address competition and this court's Comcast decision that came down a couple of weeks ago. After this court's Comcast decision, the FCC can no longer contradict us on a crucial point, and that is that the MVPD industry, number one, is competitive, and number two, that the competition is effective. And of course, you only need to look at the ads on TV to know that this is so. Just last night, I was watching TV, and you just get bombarded with advertisements by Verizon, Fios, this is Fios, this is big, et cetera, et cetera. But the FCC, throughout this proceeding, has taken the view that competition is not effective. Well, in Comcast, this court said, enough, there is competition, it's effective, and the FCC's quarrels are not persuasive. It should deal with the competition.
Comcast doesn't stand for the fact that the market is now completely mature right now and competition reigns in every area.
I think that Comcast stands at least for this proposition, even at its narrowest reading, that if that the FCC's quarrels with competition, for example, that people are unwilling to switch to DBS are unpersuasive, that the market is competitive, and that the FCC essentially has to predicate its orders on the understanding that the market is competitive. Now, there may be other justifications, but it cannot predicate its orders on the notion.
So you're saying Comcast now stands for the proposition that FCC has to take its hands off completely, that the market is mature and
it has to predicate its orders on the existence of competition. It has to deal with it.
To be sure.
And I think what the FCC is doing now, for example, in its 28J response to our letter about the Comcast case, it said, all right, well, finally, perhaps the market is effectively competitive, but that is so only because of the exclusivity rule, which is slightly different from what it said in the order or in its briefs, but let's deal with that. It says, if we would lift the ban at this particular time, the market would essentially lapse back into monopoly, and that is just not credible. That is something that the FCC cannot rationally decide. For one thing, the notion that lifting of the ban would wipe out DBS competitors who have billions of dollars of sunk cost is just not credible. That competition is there, even if they would go bankrupt, which of course they won't, but even if, there will always be DBS competition. Somebody will use those facilities.
But isn't that based on FCC's experience that that new entrants into the marketplace do in fact need access to existing content?
Well, that's another thing that the FCC has been saying. Whenever a new entrant comes into the marketplace, essentially a new incubation period starts. We need to worry again about keeping this particular new entrant alive. An economist would disagree with that. An economist would say the time to worry about competition and entry into the market is before it happens. Once it happens, once investments are actually sunk, there's much less to worry about because at that point, the competition is there and you can't put the genie back in the bottle. But quite apart from the enormous amount of competition, the notion that cable operators will withhold just about everything that they have is just preposterous. With this market share that DBS has now, there's a real cost to withholding. And as a matter of fact,
the argument's not everything. The argument is that they would withhold some key things. And I think your vision of the future is a future where consumers at homes may have to get both satellite and cable. If they want to watch NFL Sunday Ticket and watch the Phillies games, they're going to have to get both.
And NFL Sunday Ticket is, of course, a very good example in the sense that DBS has had an exclusive with respect to that. Has that put the Dish Network, the other DBS competitor, out of business? Of course not. Has it put cable out of business? Of course not. This
is the FCC allowed to look at the market and say, we don't want a marketplace where consumers to access the programming that they want have to get both cable and satellite into their homes so that homes have both coming in? Is the FCC entitled to say that's not a marketplace that we want? That would be too high a cost for consumers?
That would be both arbitrary and capricious, I think, and plainly contrary to the statute. The statute says that the ban must lift, shall cease to exist, if it is no longer necessary to preserve and protect competition. In the example that Your Honor raises, there plainly is competition. And the notion that the FCC should then say, yes, but we actually don't like competition the way we see it developing all that much, and what we really want is that consumers are not inconvenienced by effective competition. That cannot possibly be the right standard. So there is competition, and the FCC simply has to deal with it. But the FCC hasn't dealt with it, and there's a reason for that. It has applied fundamentally the wrong standard in the order under review. In the order under review, the FCC asks this question: is there still an incentive to withhold? It says only if the incentive to withhold programming disappears can we lift the rule. For example, that's very clear in paragraph 60 of the order. It says, if cable market share continues to decline, the incentive to engage in withholding will presumably diminish to the extent that we may relax the prohibition. That is fundamentally the wrong standard. If Congress had wanted a world without exclusivity, because that's apparently what the FCC is aiming for, it would not have included a sunset. You don't tell the FCC you have to specifically permit something, but only if you're certain it won't happen anymore.
But the Congress also gave them the ability to extend the sunset, right? I mean, that's not a
persuasive argument. Actually, what Congress said is there is a presumption that the ban shall cease after 10 years, and that's actually how the FCC has interpreted it in the 2002 order. Right. But if you find that it is still necessary to protect and preserve competition, then you can extend it. But that means
they say necessary. They don't say we can get to it later. But you want them to say essential, and they didn't say that.
Well, nothing really turns on that. Actually, the FCC itself has said that the question is whether without the ban, competition would still exist and would still thrive. And
yeah, there's a difference in exist and thrive. I think under any conceivable circumstance, no, not any conceivable, any likely circumstance, there's going to be some competition. This is not, the FCC is not going to see an absolute on either side of this issue.
But, Chief Judge, actually in 1992, we of course had a very different world. When this statute was first put into existence or put in place, and when the Congress said to the FCC, you have to come up with this rule, there was no DBS. DBS satellites had not yet been launched, or at least were not operational. There was no wireline competition. There wasn't. There was some other competition, but
there was
certainly
minimal,
certainly not what we have now.
You cannot be arguing that once there began to be DBS, the FCC had to from then on find there was sufficient competition to let the sunset go into effect.
Well, respectfully, that is what.
That is your argument? That the very existence of DBS is sufficient that the FCC had to allow labs?
Perhaps one could hypothesize situations where there are just satellites out there and nobody has ever bought a single subscription to DBS service.
That, suppose 1% of the market has bought it.
You're not resting on that.
Would you say that requires the FCC to permit the labs if 1% of the market has bought the DBS service?
I guess what I'm saying is this. One could hypothesize a situation where entrants come in, but it is clear from the outset that they're basically not competing, that they cannot compete. That is not the world as we have seen it.
I take it you don't want to answer my question about 1%.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I take it you don't want to answer my question about 1%.
I think my answer is that, hypothetically speaking, if
there could be a level of theoretical competition that is so low that the FCC would have to extend rather than allow the lapse. You would concede that, would you not?
The reason why I'm hesitant to say yes to that is because once facilities have been created And once they have been shown to be operational and able to provide competition, they're
That's
really
the part we come to able to provide competition.
Right.
You're saying that any level of competition is sufficient that the FCC has to allow the let.
At least enough to show that this is real competition. And, of course, that point
Even if we disagree with you on that point, your point is that the market's much more developed than that.
Precisely. The market has shown that.
There again, you don't have to die in that other ditch, right. But you seem to be hell-bent on saying that the standard is that if there's some competition, then the FCC is required to allow the less.
Very well, Your Honor.
And
just to get back,
I had a hard time believing you were arguing that until you said you were.
I understand Your Honor's point, but just to take a step back, the question that the FCC asks, whether there is an incentive or remaining incentive to withhold programming or to do exclusive deals, cannot possibly be the right answer. Even in vibrantly competitive markets, exclusivity is the order of the day. For example, AT&T has an exclusive with the iPhone. AT&T apparently thinks that if it has the iPhone, it will sell more subscriptions. And Apple apparently thinks that this is a good idea because AT&T will then...
Well, do you think the FCC is saying, and maybe they are, do you think they're saying that incentive for exclusivity has to absolutely disappear before they will quit extending?
That is exactly what the FCC has said. The FCC has said in the order that until the incentive disappears,
I thought they were saying
or diminish.
I'm sorry.
Did they use the word disappear in the order, or was it diminish?
To be very honest, the FCC never says anything with clarity that one might hope for.
In other words, no, they didn't say disappear, did they?
And it was more than incentive. It also had to find an ability to do harm from it, right?
Yeah.
Well, the ability and the incentive to withhold is what the FCC said. An ability is essentially an empty shell because, of course, if one owns programming, one can withhold it. That is always true. The question was really, is there still an incentive even while DBS and other competitors have this very big market share? Because, of course, there is now a very real cost to withholding. If you withhold from DBS, take Cablevision. Cablevision owns a number of services, AMC, IFC, Wii. It owns cable systems only on Long Island and around New York. If it were to withhold from DBS those services in all of the country, it would not get any of those license fees. It would pay an enormous price. And all of this, in the FCC's mind, would be on the hope that DBS would become so weak, I guess, that it can't compete in Long Island anymore?
I think your argument depends at some level on the idea that some exclusive agreements are going to be beneficial to consumers.
That is precisely correct.
And can you explain in terms of price, quantity, quality of programming, how that is likely to come to pass?
I think this is a crucial point because the FCC essentially ignored it. The FCC treats exclusivity as something that is all bad and never good, whereas exclusivity is really the lifeblood of competition. Competitors like AT&T use exclusivity with the iPhone as a way of making the market more competitive. Otherwise,
In
programming and in content, exclusivity is the order of the day. For example, the network.
How can it be beneficial to the consumer? We're not saying it can't, but we're asking you to give us an example of how it can.
In two ways, Your Honor. New services get established by offering to programmers, distributors, exclusivity. A new service might say, I am struggling, I can't get distribution. If you give me distribution, then that's good for me because now I'm on the map. That's good for me because you will promote me, you will advertise for me, and any upside of the promotion and advertising that you do will belong to you. It will not redound to the benefit of your competitors. This is how new programming gets established in the marketplace. But it's not just that there's more investment in programming. It is also that distributors are able to distinguish and differentiate their product. If all the producers, of all the distributors have to provide the exact same package of programming, the only thing that they can compete on is price. It becomes a much less competitive market. Everybody provides the same package of programming, and then perhaps you get some nickels and dimes off at one place or another. Academic research shows that if you want competition, you want to have competition on as many aspects as possible. That currently is not permissible because the FCC says everybody has to provide the same package. And the FCC says the reason why we're saying that there's no upside to exclusivity is because look out there. You see lots of investment in programming already. The number of services has exploded. That, of course, cannot be the right question to ask. This court said in the unbundled network elements case, don't look at what you actually see, but rather try to predict what there would be if you didn't have compelled sharing in the marketplace. Here's how the court put it. The existence of investment at a specified level tells us little or nothing about incentive effects. The question is how such investment compares with what would have occurred in the absence of compelled sharing. And then the court said, that is the downside that has to be taken into consideration here. We can't expect the commission to offer a precise assessment of the disincentive effects, but we can expect at least some confrontation of the issue and some effort to make reasonable trade-offs. That is the nub of what went wrong in this case. The FCC never made any of those trade-offs because it says more sharing is always better. Compelled sharing is a good thing. Withholding is necessarily always a bad
thing. You used a significant word when you said prediction. Right? As a legal matter, why isn't this sort of the paradigmatic example of a predictive judgment by an expert?
It is a predictive
judgment. And we have necessarily little data because the extension of the ban, right? We don't have that much data to show what would happen in the absence of a ban because we've had the ban for such a while.
That actually is not entirely true. The FCC recognized that under the relevant standard, the intermediate scrutiny standard, anything that can be proven through facts has to be proven. And in fact, the FCC made an attempt at that. It is labeled Appendix C. Mm-hmm. It said, let's figure out what will actually be withheld if we lift this ban. Appendix C in the order.
The argument depends on this being a constitutional question, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't depend on
then
that.
Then where do you get the intermediate scrutiny from unless you're treating this as a First Amendment question?
I'm not sure I heard the question correctly, but
I think you did. You said intermediate scrutiny applies. That's a standard from First Amendment law.
That's correct, but that's
hasn't it already been held that this is not a First Amendment case, First Amendment issue?
I don't think that's correct, Your Honor. It's conceded. The FCC agrees that intermediate scrutiny applies. And it said, because that is true, but even under the arbitrary and capricious standard, we would have to quantify what would be withheld in a world without the rule. And by the way, the statute requires that too. The statute says, try to predict what would happen in a world without the rule.
Well, I just want to be clear on this. I thought you had a First Amendment argument in this case that was somewhat folded into your statutory argument. Is that correct or not correct?
I think all the roads lead to Rome here, so to speak. Arbitrary and capriciousness analysis, the First Amendment intermediate scrutiny analysis, and the statute all require the same
thing. We may not agree all the roads lead to Rome, and I just want to make sure that you have a First Amendment road.
We do very much so. Although, of course, in the context—
Is that road still open, or has it been previously closed? Has this been treated as not a constitutional issue on previous occasions by this court?
Well, this case has never been before.
No,
before
but this before. Issue, this—
Exclusivity rule.
Yeah. Exclusivity rule issue.
If Your Honor is referring to the Time Warner case—
yeah.
Right.
I couldn't think of the name of it, so thank you for reminding me what I'm referring to.
Right. It's the Time Warner case, and that's 93 Fed 3rd, 957.
Yeah.
The FCC keeps relying on that. The FCC basically says that in Time Warner, this court held that even though compelled sharing in every context in the world has been recognized to have bad effects on incentives, this court somehow held that programming and MVPD distribution is somehow an exception to that. That is not what this court held. Rather, the claim in Time Warner was that the statute was overbroad in the sense that the rule bars not only exclusivity with respect to it doesn't only bar a cable operator who owns a stake in a programming service from doing exclusive with that programming service, but that programming service also is not allowed to do any exclusive deals with other cable operators who do not own a stake in that service. And Time Warner said, or the petitioner in the Time Warner case said, that makes it overbroad and that makes this a first.
That was a facial challenge 13 years ago. This is
a
different
market. It was a facial challenge 13 years ago, and the court only said that link was too remote to say that there would be an impact on the production of new programming. The court did not say, of course, that the impact on programming wouldn't be severe from the heart of the rule. To the contrary, it said, to be sure, the ability to enter into exclusive contracts could create economic incentives to invest in the development of new programming. And that is what we have here.
Can I ask again the question I first asked, which is, I think the vision you have of the ultimate market is going to potentially increase prices for consumers significantly, because many consumers will feel the need or desire to get programming through both cable and DBS.
Your Honor, I don't necessarily think that's so, just as in many other contexts.
Now, a lot of this, the record's about sports programming. Certainly that's going to be, if you want Sunday Ticket and say the you're in Philadelphia when they had the exclusive arrangement with Comcast and you want to see, I think, the Phillies games, you're going to have to get both to get that, right?
Well,
and therefore your total price that you're paying is going to go up significantly over what you're paying if you're just getting one.
For a very small group of consumers, that will be the answer to that world.
And they may be on this bench. I don't know.
Perhaps so. And it's certainly that time of year.
Your argument, I guess, is that the overall benefits to competition outweigh the potential effects on some consumers.
Look at the iPhone. There are some people who say the iPhone is something that I have to have. But, hey, I have Verizon Wireless, which I think has a better network. Those people could say, they could either say I take both, or they could say I go with the iPhone and I hope that Verizon at some point will develop something that is just as good as the iPhone. Or they could say I stay with Verizon and perhaps Verizon has offsetting benefits. But this is how competition works. This is how competition works throughout the economy. And this is something that the FCC denies cable operators from the right from engaging in. If there are no further questions, I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the FCC.
Good morning, Amden Joshi for the FCC. I'd like to start with where Mr. Brand started, with the Comcast decision, the notion that the FCC ignored the development of competition.
Probably a good place to start. Go ahead.
Ignore the development of competition since this rule has been in effect. The FCC devoted 12 paragraphs of its order, 16 through 28, discussing how competition has developed, discussing how cable's market share has fallen, how programming networks, the number of programming networks has increased, both cable-owned and not cable-owned, and has attributed at least part of that progress in competition to the fact that competitors have access to programming that consumers want to see. So the FCC did not, this is not like Comcast, because the FCC took account of competition, but the statute, the statutory standard which the FCC has adopted in its regulation is not this rule will sunset when competition exists. It is the rule will sunset unless the FCC determines that it continues to be necessary to preserve and protect competition. And so even with the current competitive state of the market.
Why aren't the generally applicable antitrust laws sufficient to preserve competition? They've been around for 119 years and every other industry they're deemed sufficient to preserve competition.
Well, we know cable gained its monopoly while the antitrust laws were in effect. Congress determined that that was not sufficient.
That was because of a physical characteristic that's no longer present.
Well, you still have their current market dominance, although they are subject to more competition now, still lingers from that.
Well, the top four, aren't two of them DBS? Of the top four market shares?
Nationwide, but cable's market share is still at two-thirds of the whole country, much higher in many urban markets where DBS is less effective. And they still control about a third of English language programming. And you see that in how competitors are responding in the marketplace. They're paying full market price for cable-owned programming. There is no governmental rate regulation or subsidy involved here. They are still choosing to pay millions of dollars to cable companies for this programming, which, according to petitioners, they don't need at all. They can go out and develop. There's plenty, if you believe petitioners' theory, there's plenty of other programming out there in the market that they could use that, and they would be just as competitive. Yet the record shows, for example, Verizon has it's a new Fios TV service. This is a footnote 67 of the order, 32% of their channel lineup consists of vertically integrated national and regional programming. So competitors themselves recognize the value of cable-owned programming in order to compete with cable incumbents and attract subscribers. And the examples we do have of terrestrial.
You mentioned something about market shares. the Washington Post's market share 7 times or 8 times or something the Washington Times, could Congress make a determination that the Washington Post should share its columnists with the Washington Times, so the E.J. Dionne and Charles Krauthammer and George Will and Al Kamen columns must appear in both the Post and the Times so that the Times readers have access to that same?
Well, I think an ounce of history is worth a pound of logic here. We have a 500-year history of dealing with newspapers, and so to have the government come in at this point in our history and try to regulate them would be a little bit different.
Hasn't the Supreme Court said, though, that cable operators are similarly situated to bookstore owners and newspapers in the service they provide when they select programming for consumers?
Well, cable operators are entitled to certain First Amendment protections, but the court has also made clear that each medium has its own set of characteristics that justify different levels of regulation.
How is the cable operator's selection of what programming to include different from a newspaper's choice of what columnists to negotiate an exclusive agreement with for that person's columns to appear in the newspaper?
Well, this, just to be clear, this rule does not prohibit cable operators from choosing which programs they want to put on their networks.
Right. No, I understand it, but to get an exclusive, I understand that, to get an exclusive agreement with the programming network so that it can't appear on the competitor. How is that different from what the newspaper does when it negotiates an exclusive agreement with a columnist to have the columnist's columns appear only in that paper in the local area?
I think in the newspaper industry, I understand the current example of the Washington Post with their market share, but you don't have that entrenched monopoly after, you know, half a millennium of development in newspapers that you do. You have with
you don't have a similar monopoly in Chicago, St. Louis, Dallas. You do have a monopoly, an entrenched monopoly there. So,
and based on market share, it's more dominant than what
Well, as this court said many times, monopoly power is not simply based on market share alone. But it, you know, there's also the issue of competitors have been able to come in.
Taking off from your focus on market shares, and if you want to apply market share analysis, then the rule you're talking about, exclusive agreements, I would think could apply to newspapers.
Well, the market share analysis goes really as applicable to the cable operator's incentive, whether they could still afford to withhold programming from competitors if the rule were to lift. I don't think there's any dispute in this case about that. That's the proper analysis to go through, and the fact that the higher the cable's market.
Is the FCC taking the position that there has to be no incentive for exclusivity before they will cease to extend the provision?
No, not at all. I think there's never going to reach a point.
What is the standard that's going to satisfy the FCC that there is enough competition in order to let it lapse?
Well, certainly more competition for cable operators. Market share is important, and if that goes down further, that would be a factor that the FCC would consider. The other factor that the FCC has considered, that's the first part of this analysis, is what's cable's continued holdings with respect to popular vertically integrated programming. They still control about a third of, you know, English language programming,
okay,
including about a third of the most popular.
Suppose they controlled a sixth. Would that be small enough that the FCC could say, all right, there's enough competition out there, let's let it lapse?
Well, I think the FCC would certainly be much closer to that direction. That we'd have to look at the entire record that was developed in about 2 years' time.
The counsel is asserting that the FCC is taking an absolutist position on that, or I understood him to be. Is that accurate or is that inaccurate? And how can I tell from the decision?
No, the FCC is not. I don't think there's ever a point where there's never an incentive to engage in exclusives. As petitioners point out, DirecTV, which is much smaller than the cable industry as a whole, has entered into certain exclusives. We also, with the NFL Network. Now, those are independent programmers, so cable has the same ability to enter into those types of exclusives as DirecTV did. So I think all of the examples that petitioners have put forward really involve exclusive agreements between companies and independent companies, not vertically integrated programming. But it's not our position that there would be no incentive. There should be no incentive to engage in exclusives. We don't think that there's ever a point where would be reached. But
are there other examples that you can point to of compelled sharing of intellectual property that Congress has imposed?
Well, the only example we point out is the one involving the copyright,
fair use.
Fair use. I apologize, I can't remember the technical term of it, but it's mentioned in our brief, the mandatory licensing under copyright law. And that's really to create a market that wouldn't otherwise exist, and the same is true here. Without this rule, we would not have a market for cable-owned programming, or at least a much more constrained market, and that would impair a competitor's ability to offer a product to cable. Now, petitioners argue that product differentiation is a positive thing, and the FCC did not consider the benefits of exclusives. But the first sentence of paragraph 63 of this order makes clear the FCC, let me just quote it, "We recognize the benefits of exclusive contracts and vertical integration cited by some of the cable MSOs, such as encouraging innovation or investment in programming and allowing product differentiation among distributors." So the FCC understood the argument, but what we've seen is the other incentive to program investment is competition itself, and the FCC found without this rule that competition would be hampered, which would itself hamper programming investment.
Usually in most industries, in the airline industry and the energy industry, what the law has developed, what Congress has developed, the courts have developed, are the antitrust laws. And I think footnote 7 of your brief says that the Department of Justice doesn't necessarily think that these kinds of exclusive agreements are antitrust violations. Is that correct reading of footnote 7?
That's correct. The Department of Justice would do it. Does a more
case
by case.
Is that still the Department of Justice's position?
I have not spoken to them about that footnote.
You haven't asked them lately.
But I mean, they do a case by case analysis of very specific transactions. That's my understanding of how they operate.
They look at threats to competition in the marketplace from vertical agreements, horizontal agreements. Obviously, vertical agreements are not deemed as threatening to competition as horizontal agreements. And why aren't those laws, which apply to every other industry, what the law, what Congress has deemed sufficient to protect competition once there's a competitor out there? Obviously, in 1992, there's no competitor out there, but even then, the Senate report says the committee believes that exclusivity can be a legitimate business strategy when there's effective competition.
The Congress provided for those instances where exclusive contracts can be beneficial. There is a waiver provision in the statute, public interest exception.
Let me show you. The FCC agrees that exclusivity in this area can be beneficial to competition.
Yes. No, I mean, the FCC pointed out, I think, no less than 7 times in this order that there is a waiver provision for exclusive contracts that are beneficial to investment and not harmful for competition. The factors Congress put forward go through each of those issues. The first two talk about competition. The third factor has the FCC look at the benefits to investment. Now, in 15 years, we would think if there was this detrimental impact on investment, we would see some example of that in 15 years, in the 15 years that this rule has been in effect. We haven't seen an exclusivity petition in about...
Counsel, the trouble with that argument is it's rather like the old question about how many miles are there of unexplored caves. We don't know what would have happened as far as investment in the absence of this rule.
Well, we do know that the cable operators could have filed for public interest exceptions, and we have not seen one of those since the 1990s. At that time, you know, the FCC granted a few and denied a few, but we would expect that if there was this, the example Mr. Brands gave about a new programmer wanting to get exclusives in exchange for the cable operator's investment, that's a quintessential.
How many more extensions are there going to be?
What's that?
How many more extensions are there going to be?
Well, the next review is in 2012, which is about a couple of years away. We've already seen it's a dynamic market. Time Warner no longer controls vertically integrated programming. Earlier this year, they've divested their cable assets from their programming assets.
Shouldn't the ban also apply to DBS?
The ban does, actually, at least to DirecTV. There's a merger condition on them that requires them to adhere to the same ban.
Dish?
Dish doesn't. I don't believe they own any vertically integrated programming. They haven't been involved in any mergers that we've reviewed recently. So as a practical matter, I don't think it affects them.
That sort of brings me back to where you started. What I heard you start with the Comcast decision, but I'm not sure that I ever heard you say what the FCC says is the effect, if any, of the Comcast decision on the issues in this case.
We don't think there is. We think Comcast dealt with a completely different issue, which was whether CableNet had enough of a bottleneck to prevent programmers from gaining access to consumers and hurting their viability. The issue of whether they have a bottleneck with this rule in place certainly is not present here. The question is, what would happen, and it does involve the FCC's predictive judgment, what would happen if we allow this rule to sunset? And
at what point do we decide the predictive judgment has been indulged long enough?
Well, I think it would depend on the record. We think this record certainly supports the predictive judgment. All we have on the other side in terms of record evidence is there the cable industry's alternative predictive judgment.
Is there still a bottleneck?
The commission did not have to reach a bottleneck issue in this order. This rule is valid even if cable
does
not.
There's no longer a bottleneck. How is the ban necessary to preserve competition?
Because the competition that exists still depends on access to the vast array of programming that the cable industry continues to control. At some point, that may not be the case. That competition will have matured enough that we will not have that. It can be sustained even in the absence of the exclusivity prohibition. You know, in two more years, the telephone companies will have 5 years of further investment into the MVPD market. So this is a dynamic market, and things are moving rapidly. But at this on this record, we think the FCC certainly was well within its administrative discretion in determining that we hadn't yet reached the end point of this transition from monopoly to full competition. The only other point I would like to make is that petitioners raised the example of the investment disincentives that was discussed in the USTA case involving network elements for phone companies. I would point out that if you read that opinion, what the court was concerned about there was not the sharing per se, but you had sharing of all of the elements of the incumbent's network at government-set rates. Here, the rates are set by the market. The networks are not shared. The programming must be negotiated for in good faith, but there is still a vast array of programming channels that are out there that competitors compete on. Like I mentioned before, cable-owned programming is about a third of what MVPDs tend to offer. That's at least two-thirds of programming channels where competition can flourish, in addition to issues like competition on price.
The same net that I finally did with your opposing counsel. What standard of review is applicable in this case? Counsel says that the FCC agreed that the intermediate scrutiny standard applies. In your brief, after you discuss the our APA standard, you then say, well, to the extent that the commission's decision to extend the exclusivity provision implicates the First Amendment, it is subject to review under intermediate scrutiny. That didn't tell me a whole lot. To the extent the commission's decision implicates the First Amendment doesn't tell me how much you think it implicated it. If it implicated it none, then we're looking at arbitrary and capricious for the whole thing. If it implicated it a whole lot, then we're looking at intermediate scrutiny. What is your position on the standard of review here?
Well, we haven't seen, I don't think the petitioners have really put forth a straight First Amendment claim. Mm-hmm. The major issues they raise, we think, were decided by Time Warner. There is still a substantial governmental interest here under intermediate scrutiny. And the rule is the same. We don't think it's any more overbroad now than it was then. They had raised an issue of how necessary should be construed in their opening brief, whether the doctrine of constitutional doubt should be applicable. I think they dismissed that in their reply brief.
The last time I was involved in an opinion that construed necessary to mean essential, the Supreme Court told us that necessary doesn't mean essential. That was a long time back, and that was transportation rather than communication.
But the key point on your question, Judge Santel, I want to make is even under intermediate scrutiny, the FCC still gets deference for its predictive judgments. That's what the Bell South case holds. So I don't think it makes a dime's worth of difference in terms of how this analysis comes out.
Do you think intermediate scrutiny under the First Amendment is the same thing as arbitrary and capricious?
No, in terms of how this case comes out, okay. In terms of the deference the commission gets on its prediction. If the court has no further questions, I would ask that the commission's order be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the intervener.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court.
Good morning, Ms. Walker.
Helgi Walker for interveners Verizon, AT&T, and EchoStar. I'll go quickly. I'd like to bring the court back to the overarching framework here. We are operating against the backdrop of Section 628C, where Congress made the fundamental policy cuts at issue here that are essentially petitioners' problems. Congress decided that this particular class of exclusivity agreements, given the history of this industry, the vertically integrated nature of it, and the non-replicable nature of the programming at issue.
Does that respond to the questions about antitrust law?
Yes, Congress decided antitrust laws were in full force and effect at the time 628 was passed. Congress made the fundamental policy judgment that this was necessary at the time. And by the way, Congress also, in the sunset provision, knowingly, and we must presume deliberately, gave the FCC broad discretion to decide whether the rule should ultimately sunset. Congress knows how to sunset a provision at a date certain. Section 274G2 in Title 47 is a good example of that. They did not do it here. So we have a fundamental policy decision by Congress, notwithstanding academic research and economists' opinions that petitioners cite, that this was important. This court's role is limited in such a case. I'd like to draw the court's attention to the cases that are directly relevant here. And those are the predictive judgment cases mentioned by Judge Griffith, and also this court's opinion in NCTA and the Wold case cited in our brief. Where the commission, by necessity, and here because of the nature of the task that Congress gave it, to decide whether a rule that's been in effect for a long time should be lifted, does so with reasonable assumptions, and evidence supported by the record, this court's review must respectfully come to an end. In Wold, then Judge Ginsburg reminded us that in such a situation, the court's real answer to a petitioner who's heatedly criticized the economic analysis of an agency is that they've really come to the wrong forum.
Isn't there a difference when Congress imposes a special obligation on the media as opposed to letting generally applicable laws apply to First Amendment editors and speakers? I thought that's what the Supreme Court said in Turner and other cases. Well, it's one thing to apply generally applicable tax, antitrust, labor laws to First Amendment editors and speakers, but it's another thing for the government to single out those people for special obligations.
Petitioners have not directly and cogently raised a First Amendment attack on the statute. And the reason for that is likely, as Judge Sentell pointed out, Chief Judge Sentell, we have Time Warner One on the books already. This is not an adequately preserved argument. And in any event, Congress, again, there is no law that restricts newspapers in this way. 628 does, and Congress gave the FCC broad discretion in flexible terms that binds this court to lift the rule unless it finds that competition and diversity would not be preserved and protected. Those are broad terms. Those are prophylactic terms. And the question is not, Judge Kavanaugh, as my esteemed counsel, Mr. Brand, said, whether the incumbents would withhold just about everything. The question is whether they would withhold programming that's critical to competitive efforts.
Like Massillon in Northern Virginia.
Like that, and like the very popular vertically integrated networks at issue. So it's not just consumers, Judge Kavanaugh, who have to go out and get two sources of video programming to get their preferred programming, the consumers who are lucky enough to be able to afford to do that. It's the consumers who would like a meaningful alternative to their current subscriber, and they're not getting that alternative.
Judge Kavanaugh thinks he's had a long enough answer to his
question. Okay.
Your time is expired.
So thank you.
Was there any time left for petitioner?
There's no time left for petitioner.
We'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
First point, First
Amendment.
Can
you address Ms. Walker's point that there is no First Amendment issue in this case?
I don't know where she gets that. I'm sorry. With all due respect, I'm
How
sorry.
Clearly do you raise a First Amendment
On
issue?
Page 32, we have a paragraph that says. Page 32 of our opening brief, the exclusivity rule, the FCC has acknowledged the order under review is also subject to intermediate scrutiny. exclusivity rule imposes an onerous burden. We go on and on and on talking about the
No, you don't go on and on and on talking about a First Amendment issue. You may have just given us about all you had to say other than the marginal references to the First Amendment. Is that sufficient to bring a constitutional question before us?
Absolutely, Your Honor. We set up here the standard of review.
You go back and mention the First Amendment again on page 34, and you stick in something in a footnote about it. But we are not loath to take on constitutional questions unless they're squarely presented.
And the court.
I'm not even sure when I get through reading your brief references what your First Amendment challenge is.
The First Amendment challenge is simply this. Under intermediate scrutiny, the court cannot affirm unless it finds that the FCC has shown, has borne its burden to show by substantial evidence that there is a non-conjectural problem that requires being solved. This is a standard that is slightly more exacting than the arbitrary and capricious standard, although that standard gets the court in the same place. I'd like to say a couple more things. Ms. Walker points to Section 628. I think what Ms. Walker doesn't point to is that Section 628 has a sunset provision. That is just a key concern in this case. There's a sunset provision that tells the FCC, unless you can make a particular finding, this has to go. Finally, I think the answer that the FCC gave to, well, when will it be enough? When will there be enough competition? Was simply, well, there has to be always more. There has to be more competition. Things are moving in the right direction, but it's not enough yet. That is something that the FCC has been saying now for 17 years. And will say for many years.
It's true for a lot of those 17 years.
Well, it certainly has not been true.
Doesn't the FCC have a point when they say that the current market is a result of what Congress put in place in 1992 and the FCC's rules implementing that?
I think that the rule may have had a place and a time. That time and place have come and gone. And it apparently the FCC.
What was the threshold? At what point did it come and go? And how's the FCC supposed to make that determination with the broad delegation of power that Congress has given
it has
them.
Come and gone when competitors felt able to sink investment and actually made the sunk investments. Now,
when was that? What's the empirical data? I mean, we're talking about thresholds that need to be crossed, and you say it's crossed. When was it crossed? And how is your judgment any better than FCC saying, well, it's about to be crossed? These seem to me to be the classic sorts of decisions that Congress has delegated to the agencies language.
Well, with all due respect, I think that the FCC is just asking the wrong question. The FCC is applying the wrong standard. And if we defer to the FCC, this will never happen.
Can you answer Judge Griffith's question? When I think he asked, when did the time go?
I think certainly when every consumer in the country had access to three providers of MVPD service, it was a pretty good time to let go.
And what's your basis for that conclusion?
Every consumer has
three.
Right, so three is the standard.
A cable operator, a DBS operator, DirecTV, and a DBS operator, Dish Network. Now there's, in most places, also a fourth provider, the local telephone company like Verizon, Fios. This is Fios. This is big. Or AT&T.
So you say once the consumer had three choices, there's nothing in the statute that says once you have three choices, it's all.
Of course not.
These are judgments that Congress has delegated to the FCC, and unless they are arbitrary and capricious in their decision,
standard, and the statutory standard is that the FCC has to show that it is necessary to preserve and protect competition, and they
necessary
have
is an ambiguous phrase, right?
Well, the FCC now concedes that the current situation looks pretty good, and this is where we want to be. The FCC says, however, if we now lift the rule, everything will fall apart.
Won't it be back to the FCC? What's the next review?
2012. And in fact,
we said that a while ago. Yeah.
I was pleased to hear that my opponent says things are looking good. Things are looking on the up for 2012. Well, by saying that, he also makes my case, I think, for vacature. Because if things look so good, then there's really no harm.
I can only remember one time that we've ever told the FCC your predictive judgments are not going to be upheld. The Bechtel case, and that was decades of imposition of a licensing condition on telecom, and there was no review date set. This is going to be reaching out quite a lot for us to say predictive judgments are not good enough.
I don't think so, Your Honor. That is exactly what happened in the Comcast case. In the Comcast case, the FCC was tasked with setting a reasonable subscriber limit, a reasonable subscriber limit. That sounds about as vague
as it
sounds.
That's the next one after Bechtel, I think.
I'll take it. It's 2 weeks old.
That's a good one. You were on the panel.
And it happened
there. You didn't almost dissent, I take it.
It happened there in exactly the same industry, dealing with exactly the same competition. The FCC there, too, said, it is not enough now, but we're moving in the right direction. Hold on. It's coming. It wasn't enough there, and it shouldn't be enough here.
Thank you, counsel. We've let everybody go over their time this case. We're really very generous, but we are out now. And give us a recess.